on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
It is a renaissance in many ways, and I thought about the timing of this, you know, and it is interesting that it's coming along with the rise in artificial intelligence, like we mentioned, and the singularity, but even more so, I think there's something more important that it ties into. I mean, first, let me say that, you know, it's interesting that the discovery of LSD itself was interestingly timed with the first nuclear explosions, first nuclear bombs that went off. And many people think that this was no accident. You know, Albert Hofmann's discovery of LSD, or the psychoactive effects of LSD rather, was just within a couple of months of the first nuclear bomb blast. And many people think that this was a way of kind of balancing the awesome power that we now had with a more, you know, spiritual empathy, you know, towards other human beings, and that LSD was a way of helping to promote that. And likewise, in our time, you know, the fact that psychedelics are finally being taken seriously, they're finally, you know, being researched in, you know, major universities. I mean, there's almost not even a major university now that doesn't have a whole, you know, whole building devoted to psychedelic research. It's extraordinary. And we're also going into, you know, areas like, you know, DMT entity research and psychic phenomena, not just looking at the, you know, the medical potential of it, which is of course great, but I think the main tie-in, the main reason why psychedelics are becoming more popular now than ever before, is because we are in a profound ecological crisis, and they raise environmental awareness and raise ecological consciousness more than anything else.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author David J. Brown to discuss his latest book, Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity. David touches upon topics such as consciousness after death, DMT entities, and the ecological crisis. The conversation delves into philosophical questions about reality, materialism, the future of human evolution, and the connections between technological advancements and the rise of psychedelic research. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. David J. Brown holds a master's degree in psychobiology from New York University. A former neuroscience researcher at the University of Southern California, he has written for Wired, Discover, and Scientific American. He is the author of more than a dozen books, including Dreaming Wide Awake, Women of Visionary Art, and Frontiers of Psychedelic Consciousness. He joins me today to discuss his latest book, Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity. David, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you, Nick. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I am really excited to speak with you. I told you in email that I have your book, Dreaming Wide Awake. It's been a while since I read it, but I do have that. And I didn't know that you were behind this, but the MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, I don't know if you call it a journal, but they had a print edition of Psychedelics and Ecology. And I believe you were behind that. And I've got that. I've had that for years. I keep holding on to it. So it's an honor for me to speak with you. So I'm really excited about it.
Thank you.
So to begin, I thought that maybe we could just say a few words about your background, kind of what led you to cover the material that you cover. I also told you I'm a little bit jealous. I think your first interview was with Terrence McKenna. You knew Robert Anton Wilson, you knew Tim Leary, you interviewed Noam Chomsky, all my heroes. So maybe if you could just share a little bit about who you are and the work you've done.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yeah, I do feel very blessed by the wonderful experiences I've been so lucky to have. My background is in psychobiology and neuroscience. I became particularly interested in the brain after my LSD experience when I was 16 years old. I got very curious about the nature of consciousness and the role that the interplay between the brain and consciousness. And that became the forefront of what I studied for years at New York University and the University of Southern California, where I worked on my undergraduate and graduate work and did some basic neuroscience research at NYU and USC, and worked in psychiatric hospitals for a while. And the way I got started doing the interviews and getting to know, well, I did have access to a lot of these people before I started doing the interviews. I was friendly with Terence McKenna and Tim Leary and other people like that because we had mutual friends and I had been very excited and I was a fan of all their books. And I was late one night, my partner at the time, Rebecca McClendon, and I were discussing. We used to sit up late at night and get stoned and have these philosophical discussions about what is the purpose of life, what happens to consciousness after death, what's, you know, your idea about God or future, or, you know, all the big kind of really big questions. And we sort of thought in this great, you know, audacious moment, you know, why not ask some of these great thinkers, you know, what they think about some of these big questions. So that was how we set off on doing Mavericks of the Mind, which set the, you know, set the pathway for the course of my life, where I started doing a lot of interviews. I've now done 7 collections of interviews since then. You've mentioned some of the people who I was fortunate enough to interview. Terence McKenna was indeed the very first interview that we ever did. We met him at the Esalen Institute down in Big Sur, and we sat in a circle together, and Terence brings out this very, very powerful joint of sensimilla laced with hashish and pass it around the circle as we begin the interview. And after just a couple of hits off that joint, I was just too stoned to really say much besides that dutifully just kind of read the questions off of my piece of paper, which I did, and somehow managed to make it through the end. But the cannabis just seemed to fuel Terence's, you know, active mind, and he was, you know, blazingly articulate and, you know, just a wild visionary, and just probably the best storyteller that I ever met. So that's sort of set the course for my interviews. I've gotten to interview many, many great thinkers throughout the years, and I'm still doing it to this day. My most recent collection that you mentioned, Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity, interviewed Duncan Trussell, Rupert Sheldrake, Hamilton Morris, Grant Morrison, Grant Hancock, and many other fascinating people. So, yeah, I also feel very, just very grateful for having these wonderful opportunities.
Yeah, it's a really good book. I enjoyed it very much, and that you added to my library some of the people that you were interviewing and some of the book recommendations. And again, I was also jealous of some of the people that you interviewed in this current book. Eric Davis, for example, I loved his Technosis. That was an influence for me on my master's thesis. Jeffrey Kripal is also a hero of mine. And, you know, I've known about Grant Morrison and Graham Hancock and all the others for a long time. Really impressive. And I love how you're asking similar questions. There's a set of questions that you ask almost everyone, and just the answers, how they differ. And some of them are the same and some of them are different. So it's a really good read. It's a very fun read and a very enlightening read.
Thank you.
But before we get into some of the material, I thought that maybe we should start with the title itself, Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity. And so for anyone who may not be aware of the singularity, or also to clarify, because I think there are different ways of understanding it, what is the coming singularity?
Yeah, that's the big question, huh?
Yeah.
Well, the term singularity is a term that was borrowed from physics. It basically refers to the point in which the known laws of physics break down. Like, for example, in the center of a black hole, or what happened, you know, before the Big Bang that created the universe. We can only sort of unravel time back to a certain point, or, you know, address these things up to a certain limit, and then, you know, the mathematical constructs that we have and the laws of physics break down. So that idea, the idea of a singularity, has been sort of used as a poetic metaphor. It was originally used in some science fiction novels, and it was adopted by a computer scientist, Ray Kurzweil, who has used this as a way of describing the point in our future where machine intelligence or computer intelligence accelerates to the point where it's not only smarter than human beings, but smarter than the combined intelligence of all human beings, smarter than the collective intelligence of every human being. And Ray has been pretty, you know, pretty right on with his predictions. His first book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, which was published back in the 1990s, he sort of plots out on a graph according to what's called Moore's Law, or the exponential growth of computer computations, the amount that we can do per year, you know, per cost. And he shows how it's been just, you know, gradually accelerating, not in a linear sense, but in an exponential sense. So 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, et cetera. So it's just been doubling and doubling. And he predicted back in the 1990s that by the end of the 2020s, that we would have artificial general intelligence. In other words, the ability for human beings, for ability for a computer to mimic virtually everything that a human brain does. So people like Elon Musk and others think we're now only a few years away from that. Ray Kurzweil predicted it by 2029. When he originally predicted it back in the 1990s, some people thought it would never happen. And, you know, the people that did think it would happen, they sort of put it towards the end of the 21st century. So, you know, it seems to be happening, according to Ray Kurzweil's predictions, pretty much right on. So if we're headed towards AGI, artificial general intelligence, within the next 4 or 5 years, he predicts that the singularity, the point at which the computer intelligence greater than all collective humanity, will be reached somewhere around the 2040s. So that's simply the point that we can't predict what comes next, just like, you know, the same with the mathematical formulas that are used to look into what happens, you know, in physics at the center of a star or the beginning of the universe. We just have no way of knowing. And we're in that same position right now when we look at what happens after the singularity. We have no idea what an alien intelligence that's smarter than all human beings combined is going to do. So all we can kind of do is hope that, you know, the foundation, the preliminary programming, what it learned from us is that it's going to work to help better the world and make the world a better place. But we don't know what's going to happen, which is why there, many people are predicting either, you know, a great promise or great peril from this forthcoming possibility.
Yeah, my personal opinion is we're going to find ourselves living in a Kafka novel.
Very well might. It's very possible.
But the next question that's connected to this is still with the title, what then is the role of psychedelics and the singularity?
Well, psychedelics are nonspecific brain amplifiers, according to Dan Groff, but I think they also activate areas of the brain that are lying dormant, that are just sort of waiting to be activated. There's a long connection between computer technology and psychedelics. There's a wonderful book called What the Dormouse Said. I'm forgetting the author, but it's all about how many of the programmers and technology designers in Silicon Valley had migrated there from the Bay Area, and many of them had experience with psychedelics and attribute their psychedelic experience to the development of the computer technology. One of the best examples of that, of course, is Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, co-founder of Apple Computer, who, you know, famously said that doing LSD was one of the 5 most important things of his life. So there's that long connection. And I think a lot of people, when they're working with computers, they feel a kind of seamless connection between the states of consciousness that psychedelics engender and working with the, you know, computers and being on the internet and connecting with other people in this kind of virtual space, and virtual reality kind of then grows out of that. But back to what I was saying at the beginning, I think that psychedelics activate dormant centers of our brain. And I think those centers are going to mesh very well with where we're going with artificial intelligence. You know, when I talk about the future possibilities where computer intelligence is greater than the intelligence of all collective humanity, it's not necessarily going to be separate from us, because we'll be able to implant chips in our brain that'll be able to allow us to merge with these states of information processing. So it may not just be, you know, them, you know, us versus them, but it may be sort of us evolving into a higher state. And I think psychedelics and artificial intelligence and, you know, the advance of robotics and the raising of, you know, ecological awareness and psychic phenomena, all these things kind of mesh together, I think, into what the coming singularity is going to bring.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you for that. Isn't it also the case, though, that Terence McKenna, to kind of go back to him for a second, he had his own version of kind of a singularity, didn't he?
Yeah, it's not really the first time in human history that people have thought about this sort of thing. I mean, Teilhard de Chardin, the French philosopher, talked about, the evolution of humanity and evolution of consciousness reaching something called an omega point. And the omega point roughly corresponds to this idea as well. Terence developed it. He had this idea that time sort of worked as a wave, and that, and as the wave propagated itself through space, what accelerated and what kept increasing was something that he defined as novelty, or, just the newness. And he thought that the amount of novelty, the amount of newness that human beings experience in their consciousness is something that's accelerating and that's growing in a kind of exponential fashion, the same way I described computer intelligence. And Terence postulated that there was some point in our future. He had initially said 2012, but he also said that it could have been any point in the far future. He didn't know when exactly it was. He tried to time it with the Mayan calendar ending. That was his motivation behind that. But the point at which the novelty wave reaches its final culmination is a point that he describes as where novelty becomes infinite. In other words, where there's an infinite expansion of novelty into space. And again, that's like the omega point or the singularity, where we just can't predict what happens after that point, because nothing in our past or in our history has given us the ability to understand what's really happening. So we're in uncharted territory.
Yeah, it's not, McKenna's ideas are not antithetical, I don't think, to Kurzweil's idea of the singularity. And what I always remember from McKenna is the idea of the transcendental object at the end of time, that there was something that was pulling us towards it, pulling us towards this singularity. And I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that? Do you think that we're being pulled towards something?
It seems that way to me at times when I've thought about it under the influence of psychedelics. So I discussed this idea with Rupert Sheldrake. And Rupert Sheldrake, the biologist that I worked with for 5 years, who is developed the idea of morphic field theory, or the theory of formative causation. He told me that he didn't think that, we could really have influence from the future. The whole idea behind morphic field theory is that the presence of the past is influencing us right now, and that the past is propagating itself, and that we resonate with, what's happened in the past, and that the more likely something that happens in the past, the more likely that the more that something happens in the past, the more likely it is to happen in present day. So he didn't see so much the idea of a future object pulling us, but it certainly feels that way to me at times. And I personally think that it could work both ways, that we could, the present moment could be experiencing, a pull and a push from the past and a pull from the future. But there may be more than one future, so there may be multiple possibilities, and which future we're being pulled toward maybe is the who knows. But I'm not so sure that there's only one future. But the idea that the transcendental object of time at the end of time is pulling us corresponds with Terence's idea that we're going to reach a point of infinite novelty, and beyond that we can't predict what happens next.
The follow-up question, and this is the last question in regards to the title, is still with psychedelics. If the singularity, as Ray Kurzweil understands it, is technological, are psychedelics then, do you view those as a technology?
I do. As I mentioned earlier, I think that they allow us to access dormant areas of the brain, circuits of the brain that are already there. And I think that, they fit in like a lock fits into a key, and that not only are they technologies that can be used for good or for ill, like all technology, it's neutral in its foundation, but can be used, to both enslave or to liberate human beings. But I think that as a technology, it's going to keep improving. That we're going to get better and better at being able to design. I think that they're very crude right now. I think that they're crude technologies, and that, LSD, I think is such a wide spectrum, and will have you know, drugs or, you know, brain technologies in the future, whether they're, you know, chemical or whether they, you know, use transcranial brain stimulation or some other way of stimulating different areas of the brain or dormant brain centers, and that we'll be able to do it with a kind of more, you know, pinpoint precision, you know, with these things. You know, if you just want to say amplify your hearing for, you know, for a concert, you know, for an hour, you know, without having to go through a 12-hour LSD trip, you know, or something like that. So I think they're going to get more specific and better with the help of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, it seems really interesting to me as well that we are undergoing what many refer to as a psychedelic renaissance, and that it's happening so close, kind of in conjunction with this heading towards a singularity. And it almost seems as if there's no accident in that at all.
Yeah, I've thought about that a lot. I mean, I started writing about psychedelics, you know, my career, you know, 40 years ago, really. And I've, you know, just watched how they've been, you know, criminalized, ridiculed, demonized, and ignored by the mainstream media for so many years. And, you know, I wrote an article back in 2000 for Scientific American about psychedelics, and it was the first mainstream article at the time, you know. And after that, there's now been this, like, you know, this kind of amazing influx where they're not only being taken seriously, but almost being celebrated. You know, it is a renaissance in many ways. And I thought about the timing of this, you know, and it is interesting that it's coming along with the rise in artificial intelligence, like we mentioned, and the singularity. But even more so, I think there's something more important that it ties into. I mean, first, let me say that, you know, it's interesting that the discovery of LSD itself was interestingly timed with the first nuclear explosions, first nuclear bombs that went off. And many people think that this was no accident. You know, Albert Hofmann's discovery of LSD, or the psychoactive effects of LSD, rather, was just within a couple of months of the first nuclear bomb blast. And many people think that this was a way of kind of balancing the awesome power that we now had with a more, you know, spiritual empathy, you know, towards other human beings, and that LSD was a way of helping to promote that. And likewise, in our time, you know, the fact that psychedelics are finally being taken seriously, they're finally, you know, being researched in, you know, major universities. I mean, there's almost not even a major university now that doesn't have a whole, you know, whole building devoted to psychedelic research. It's extraordinary. And we're also going into, you know, areas like, you know, DMT entity research and psychic phenomena, not just looking at the, you know, the medical potential of it, which is, of course, great. But I think the main tie-in, the main reason why psychedelics are becoming more popular now than ever before, is because we are in a profound ecological crisis. And they raise environmental awareness and raise ecological consciousness more than anything else. Certainly, you know, they can do it overnight. You know, it's like, you know, nothing else can do that overnight. It's like Scrooge in the Christmas Carol, just one night, and, you know, and you can turn somebody around from a, you know, cigar smoking CEO to a, you know, to a hardcore environmentalist. So, you know, they've even done scientific studies that show that many people who are involved in environmental movements, you know, had their first experiences with, you know, becoming one with nature and, you know, unifying with their environment through a psychedelic, and how that, you know, how that led to their environmental action. I mean, when you do a psychedelic in nature, almost everybody has the experience of, you know, the boundaries between their senses and their body blurring with the natural environment, and that, you know, it's no longer becomes, you know, something that we do for the environment, but rather, you know, we are the environment now. We feel it in a very visceral way. You know, we become one with it, and we realize that if we're polluting the environment, we're polluting ourselves. So I think that this was a very necessary evolution in our consciousness that was, you know, that was sent direct from genetic intelligence, you know, direct from the Gaian matrix, you know, the Mother Earth, you know, to help raise our awareness and stop the, you know, huge climate emergency and save our biosphere before it's too late.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I've often felt that, especially with plant medicines like ayahuasca and psilocybin, and in particular ayahuasca, I've always had the feeling that that's, you know, that's Mother Earth, that's Pachamama, that's sending it out saying, y'all need to start healing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's the most commonly experienced with ayahuasca and peyote and magic mushrooms and San Pedro cactuses, the plants that come from the earth or seem to be speaking to us in this manner.
So I want to look at some of the questions that you asked people in the book because I find them really interesting. And some of them I'm curious about. So, for example, one that makes sense to ask is sort of the question of, are we living in a simulation?
Yeah, that's such a fascinating idea. The, simulation theory, which was like, is first proposed by Nick Bostrom at Oxford, who wrote a paper on it around 20 years ago. It's sort of an older idea that, that reality can be an illusion, but the idea behind simulation theory was that, we're getting so close right now with our own simulations with virtual reality. We can now, put on a pair of goggles and headphones and immerse ourselves in a completely three-dimensional environment that, it's pretty convincing. I have one of these Quest 2s and it really is pretty awesome to be able to immerse yourself in these 3D environments with other people and be able to, interact together. And we can, this technology was first developed back in the, back in the 1990s, early 1990s. People like Jaron Lanier were working on it, and it was just, pretty much like, 3D Pong at the time. And now it's, it's close to photorealistic. So we can imagine, where this is headed and where it's going. And certainly with the, the evolution of artificial intelligence, we'll be able to eventually simulate realities that are indistinguishable from the reality that we're presently in. And if we're so close to doing that, just within, probably a few decades at the most, really, then what is, then surely if there's other life, intelligent civilizations in the universe, they've figured this out a long time ago, many of them had. So if that's the case, they've sort of done these sort of mathematical probability calculations, that if that's the case, the chances of us actually living in the base reality and not living in a simulation, would be something like thousands to one. So it's also a very common idea that people have when they're under the influence of a psychedelic. Sometimes, reality just has this kind of appearance of looking like a computer simulation, and we feel like we have some kind of insight sometimes into the nature of that simulation. So it's become a popular theory in the psychedelic community. And it's maybe something that we'll never know the answer to, whether we actually live in a simulation or not, but it's certainly a philosophically fun idea to speculate about and to wonder about, and may very well be true.
And it's something that has been speculated. I mean, it's not that far away from Plato, you know, the allegory of the cave. I
Right.
forget who it was in the book, but someone that you interviewed made the comment that it could lead this idea of whether we, or the question of whether we live in a simulation, it could lead to this sort of infinite regress. That, you know, it's like, well, if we say that we live in a simulation, how do we know that, you know, the it just doesn't keep going? And it brought to my mind the question of, where do you get to what is real? What the base
Yeah.
is that's being simulated, you know?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of what's the name of that wonderful film. Oh, it's called Waking Life, where, you keep waking up, dream within dreams within dreams, and, where is the base reality? And that may be an accurate view of our reality. It may be just, one nested reality in another and another, and it may be an infinite regress.
Well, what it made me think of, I'll geek out here just for a second, because you mentioned the Matrix several times in the book. And that, of course, is, you know, our modern touchstone for this idea. But, you know, there's a scene in the very early part of the movie, and you probably know this, where before Keanu Reeves knows he's in the Matrix, when the people stop by and he sees the woman with the white rabbit tattoo, and he's got like a program for them. And the book he's got it in is Jean Baudrillard, Simulacrum and Simulacrum. I'm probably screwing that up, but it's the chapter on nihilism. But what Baudrillard said is there is no original. It's just copies after copies after copies.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you wonder why when Neo, you know, when he took the red pill, why he didn't wonder, you know, that that wasn't another level of the simulation, you know, the simulation, you know, keep increasing. I mean, what makes him think that was the base reality? It certainly sounded a lot more fantastic than the original one. So, you
Well,
know,
I love
so.
that question of that you brought up in the book of whether the red pill was a psychedelic.
Right. Yeah. It seems like that's a metaphor. A lot of people think that. Yeah.
Well, there's so much in that film that, you know, it's tw over 20 years now and we're still dissecting it and thinking about it. One of the other questions that came up, or some of the other questions that you asked in this book, I found them curious. I think they're great questions, but I'm kind of curious as to the connection with this idea of the singularity. For example, what comes after death? I mean, consciousness is such a huge part of this, especially with psychedelics. I can see that, you know, and lucid dreaming. How do these fit into this larger theme?
Well, the idea of the singularity actually came at the end of the book, to be honest. It was after the book was done. All my interview books, from Mavericks of the Mind, Voices from the Edge, Conversation on the Edge of the Apocalypse, Frontiers of Psychedelic Consciousness, they're all about the evolution of consciousness. That's the theme of all of them. So I've been asking these questions: what happens to consciousness after death? I mean, when I went back to the original inspiration, you know, describing how I got involved in this, that was where it stemmed from, was this interest in how consciousness evolves. And those big questions have been, you know, the foundation for all of my interviews, you know, since the early 1990s. So I just continue to keep asking all those questions. And I, you know, as each book wraps up, you know, I realize there's kind of a collective theme that, you know, we can sum up. And this one was singularity and artificial intelligence and DMT entities were kind of the major theme that has to do with what's happening in the world today. But it's also a continuation of my series about the evolution of consciousness that I started with Mavericks of the Mind back in the early 1990s, where I asked these kinds of questions about death and evolution and God and the future and, you know, the nature of consciousness and meaning of life and all those kinds of things. So it's a continuation of that.
Where are you personally with some of these questions, like, you know, what comes after death and the nature of God? Because I would imagine that speaking with all of these people, you know, your ideas are constantly kind of evolving as well. So where do you sit with this right now?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I ask those questions a lot because they're questions I think about, you know, almost every day. I think about what happens to consciousness after death. It's, to me, the most meaningful question because it's the greatest mystery, I think, that human beings face. And I don't have a very fixed idea about it. And I change my mind about it every day. Sometimes I do sort of lean in one direction, and then I change. You know, having been able to interview all these amazing people and get so many different varied answers, you know, has definitely affected my point of view. But it certainly hasn't, you know, I certainly haven't shifted into any kind of form of absolute belief with, you know, with what happens to consciousness after death. I personally suspect that, you know, that consciousness survives in some form after we die. You know, this is from, you know, experiences that I've had with psychedelics and out-of-body experiences and just, you know, a sort of general intuitive feeling that it continues. But, you know, I mean, for many years, I mean, I was a hardcore, you know, neuroscientist, you know, and I really did think that, you know, when neural activity ends in the brain, that's the end of our consciousness. And we just have no way of knowing. And I don't know that we'll ever be able to figure it out before, you know, and I think before we actually, each one of us actually dies and we're actually faced with that mystery. And I think there's something profoundly, just so profoundly spiritually meaningful about that, that we can never know, that we have to face that mystery at the end of our life. Because many people believe that, you know, all of life is really a preparation for death. That's one of the main ideas behind Tibetan Buddhism, and that we're preparing for this great moment where we leap off into the next, you know, next realm of possibility. So I like to keep my mind open, and I like to think about it. You know, it's a taboo subject for a lot of people to think about there because it's so frightening. you know, most people find deaths to be the most frightening thing they can imagine. You know, either that or public speaking. I think those are usually the two most frightening things to people. But that fear usually prevents people from having, you know, rational discussions about it or thinking about it in a way that, you know, that really leads to fruitful, you know, possibilities.
Yeah. Well, you know, reading your book and thinking about all this myself, it's shocking to me. Part of my background's in philosophy, and I've spent the past 20 years as a philosophy professor at some community colleges in California. But, you know, the psychedelic experience does address all of these things, you know, the important questions. And I want to get to one of these in terms of reality. And we're kind of getting at that anyway with the simulation theory. But they never talk about psychedelics. That's never in any of the textbooks.
Yeah, I think that's changing, though. I think that's starting to change. But yeah, no, it's, I was the same case, the same, you know, psychedelics were never any of the psychology books, you know, when I was in school.
I had an interesting experience last spring or last fall. I was teaching at a Jesuit university in Colorado, and I mentioned the protest by some of the indigenous protesters at the MAPS meeting in Denver. And we had been reading bell hooks, and she had this essay on tobacco. And so I thought, oh, well, let's have this conversation about the sacred use of plants being co-opted by, you know, the larger colonial culture and whatnot. And the students rebelled. I got an email concerned that I was encouraging them all to use drugs. But what I did is I used that as an opportunity to say, well, let's talk about this. Let's talk about the difference between drug and medicine and traditional use of things. So, but anyway, I just mentioned that because I really think that this should be part of the conversation. And I'm glad to see it kind of showing up a little bit more and more. But let's look at this question of, this is something I wanted to talk to you about. And I know you've got a book coming out soon, I think towards the end of the year, on DMT entities, because I find that really interesting. And I think that, and the only time I, you know, the only DMT I have experience with is with ayahuasca. So I don't have, you know, the smoking or the vaporizing of it. But I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about DMT and maybe kind of explain it for anyone in the audience who may not be familiar with it. And what these, you know, how does this challenge our ideas of ontology, of what's real, and these DMT entities? I mean, big question.
Yeah, that's certainly a big question. And like, you know, like what happens to consciousness after death, it's one of those things that I think about a lot. Well, DMT, first of all, refers to N,N-dimethyltryptamine, which is a chemical that's found ubiquitously throughout nature and in our bodies and probably our brains, certainly in the brain of other mammals and in the bodies of other mammals as well. In fact, it's so common in plants and animals that, you know, Dennis McKenna said that the world is virtually drenched in DMT. And, you know, funny thing is, nobody knows, no biochemist can tell you what it's doing there. You know, we don't know what it is. And yet it's everywhere. There's even trace amounts of it, you know, in every glass of orange juice. It's just everywhere. And you know, people like Rick Straussman, who did the initial research back in 1990 to 1995 at the University of New Mexico, thought that it might play a role in the near-death experience, you know, what people report, or possibly in, you know, brain disorders like schizophrenia, or, you know, possibly in the mystical experience. And that's pure speculation. Some people also thought dreaming, you know, there was different ideas about the role that it plays in the brain. We do know from studies with mice that when they go into cardiac arrest, their brains produce more DMT. So that sort of a possibility that it could be related to our own near-death experiences. That's more evidence for that idea. But when Rick Straussman began doing his research, he was really testing to see if people could have, you know, mystical experiences or transcendental experiences. That's, I think, what he was aiming or hoping for. And he was, you know, kind of a little shocked, you know, that over 50% of the people came back with these reports, you know, of having met other entities, you know, different beings, highly evolved beings, aliens that were more evolved than human beings. And he wasn't really sure what to make of these experiences, and actually cut the research short because he was just, you know, overwhelmed with the mystery of this, and, you know, didn't know if he was traumatizing people or what was really being gained from it. But I think that that was probably some of the most valuable scientific research that human beings have ever done, because there is seems to be genuine possibility that the beings, that the entities that people meet in these other realms, I don't have an independent objective existence of some sort. And, you know, since then there has been, you know, now they're going, people like Andrew Gallimore and others at the Imperial College in England are doing what they call extended state research, extended state DMT research, where they keep people under the influence of DMT for, you know, normally when you do DMT, if you don't do it in ayahuasca, as you had mentioned, and if you just do it on its own without an MAO inhibitor to slow it down, it normally runs its course in 5 to 10 minutes and it's over. You know, within 30 minutes, you're almost back to baseline. But so they've been doing research now at the Imperial College and elsewhere, and, in Colorado and Switzerland, to look and see what happens when people stay in this state, and can they have extended conversations with these entities. So that's research that's currently underway, and I interviewed one of the subjects in my most recent book that you just were talking about, Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity, and I just finished a book that's going to be published sometime either in September or by Christmas, I'm not sure when. It's called The Illustrated Field Guide to the DMT Entities. And this was an idea that my friend Sarah Finn and I developed around 10 years ago when we were tripping together, and we realized that there was a wide common denominator, you know, common experiences where people reported many of the same entities when they encountered these beings in hyperspace, such as, you know, the classic gray aliens, or the clowns, or the jesters, or the mantis beings, you know, or the octopus-like beings. There's a lot of common reports, and so we thought, wouldn't it be fun to put together a kind of field guide, you know, like similar to what I used to love as a kid, the golden guides to, you know, to flowering plants and reptiles and amphibians and, you know, different aspects of the natural world. And you know, and not only for fun, but, you know, but also, you know, for scientific accuracy and the beginning of trying to actually catalog these entities, you know, if they have a real genuine existence. Do I personally think that they're real? Again, you know, it's like death. It's one of those things I think about every day, and I don't really have any firm solid belief on, because it's very, very hard to distinguish. I mean, how do I know that you're conscious right now? I can only, you know, infer from your, you know, from your behavior and from you talking to me and, you know, trying to relate it back to my own experience, but there's no measure of consciousness. So I don't even know if other human beings are conscious, let alone if these, you know, entities, you know, are conscious. But I do know from personal experience with DMT that it certainly feels that way. Yeah. It certainly feels that way. You know, people describe it as being realer than real is the way. And you can't, you know, come back from the experience without being totally shaken up with your, you know, philosophical, you know, ideas of the universe being shaken to the core, basically, in terms of what's real and everything that you thought was impossible now is, you know, could actually be possible. So in the new book, The Illustrated Field Guide to the DMT Entities, you know, we try to do is try to create a sort of taxonomy of these beings and catalog them. And Sarah did wonderful illustrations of them that go along with my description. And my descriptions come from not only my own experience, but from, you know, from the scientific studies that have been done, from all the anecdotal reports that are online, and from interviewing different people. And hopefully this is just the beginning of what could be, you know, a real communication channel for us and the higher forms of intelligence in the future.
Yeah, and a map, you know,
yeah,
a map of a very strange territory, it seems. isn't it the case? I don't know if you know this, but isn't it the case that like some of the subjects in, and it's been a long time since I've read it, but Rick Strassman's book, DMT, the Spirit Molecule, that highlights his studies that he did. Some of these people had not done DMT before. I think maybe the majority of them had not, and probably weren't familiar with some of these entities, because it seems like one criticism would be, well, yeah, but if you hear these stories, then of course that's what you're going to see. But if you, I find, what I find interesting is the people who don't know the stories and have never done it, seeing what others have seen. Because that seems to put a check mark in the, yeah, this is an independent consciousness.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one of the criticisms a lot of people, you know, say, you know, in terms of the recent reports, is that Terence McKenna's lectures about self-transforming machine elves have influenced, you know, people's journeys. And certainly under a psychedelic, you know, people are tremendously suggestible. So, you know, could that have played a role in why these certain types of entities seem to come up so often? The people in Rick Strassman's study, though, this was pretty much before Terence McKenna was really, you know, became that popular. And, you know, I don't know that they were familiar with Terence's reports. They didn't have much experience with DMT, but most of them had experience with other psychedelics. So they did have some, you know, understanding of their states of consciousness, just not with that level of profound entity contact that they experienced. And, you know, in my own research, you know, for this new book, a lot of people describe, you know, encounters with deities from other cultures, you know, seeing, you know, Hindu deities, for example, with no background in, you know, in Hindu culture or things like that. So there is this kind of transcultural, you know, element or transpersonal element to these experiences, where a lot of people who, you know, have no memory of and reading anything about this also seem to report a lot of similar entities, you know.
Yeah. And it also seems that, you know, a couple of things. One, that this, you know, us heading towards this singularity, even though it's technology based, and the psychedelic renaissance, one of the things that I keep seeing, and it's brought up in your book, is a challenge to our traditional materialistic worldview. And by that, I mean the reductive materialism. And you had some folks in the book, I think that Hamilton Morris of Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia, he's like, nope, I'm a materialist, man. Right. And you had some that kind of went in between, but it seems again, like all of this is coming together and it's eliciting a change that we can kind of see a little bit. And that challenge to materialism seems to be one of them.
Yeah, well, I think that you get a greater challenge to your materialistic point of view if you have a full-blown DMT experience. I sometimes wonder, you know, when I was talking to Hamilton, if he had actually, you know, taken three full vaporized hits and found himself fully transported into a hyperspace dimension. Because I think when that happens, it's much harder to just discount it as a hallucination. It feels so real under those circumstances. You know, it's really hard to distinguish for people who haven't had that, you know, that sort of transportation into hyperspace. There's really a marked difference between DMT experiences that, you know, produce lots of wild visions and geometric colors, but you are still in the same room. And there's a certain threshold when you sort of cross over. And when you cross over that threshold, you find yourself in a completely new environment. I mean, you're just in a whole nother world. And when you've had that experience, it rattles you to the core. You know, it's very hard to keep a purely, I don't know if it rattles your materialist, rationalist, you know, point of view from the, you know, to the core, but the idea that this is a hallucination and that there's not an objective, you know, reality to it, I think that idea gets shaken pretty severely.
Yeah. Well, and I'm also interested, I knew that DMT was endogenous to the human and it's found everywhere. But I think a materialist response to a lot of these things is that, well, you're putting a chemical in and that, you know, of course you're going to have these weird things, but from a materialistic perspective, it seems like, you know, that this 3-pound lump of essentially bacon fat inside of our head, you know, that gives us a sense of consciousness, which they claim, you know, comes from a stew of chemicals and electrical discharges. What that seems to tell me is that reality is kind of chemically based in a sense. And if you alter the chemistry a little bit and have a different experience of a different reality, I don't see how you can say that that reality is any less real than this one, if they're both chemically based.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it goes back to Rick Straussman's idea that, you know, that by chemically altering the brain, what you're doing, it's like switching the channel on a TV set. Mm-hmm. You know, that we're sort of tuned into a certain, you know, level of reality right now, but it's a huge, you know, continuum of possibilities. And by changing the chemical nature of our brain, you know, we change which signal we become receptive to in that continuum of reality. So I think that, you know, that metaphor helps to explain, yeah, that idea about that.
Yeah. That's the metaphor that I always like, that the brain's kind of like receiving consciousness in a sense. And that seemed to be kind of a mark. I think it was Rupert Sheldrake. I apologize if I'm wrong, but I think he made the comment in the interview you had with him that he saw consciousness incarnating in the brain. And I kind of liked that. I thought that was a really interesting way of expressing it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's an ancient Hindu idea. That's the idea behind reincarnation, mm-hmm. which I know Rupert has a very. I lived with Rupert for a month, and he's a very spiritual person in turn, you know, in addition to being a brilliant scientist, and he's managed to really try to bridge or merge together Christianity with Hinduism. He's really tried to create a bridge between East and West spiritual beliefs.
Okay. And just to follow up on something here, you had mentioned the long-term or long state, I think, DMT studies. This was with Andrew Gallimore, I think. Have those studies have happened or they are currently happening? I'm curious if the reports of the results are coming out.
Yeah, the one of the studies, at the one at Imperial College, the first phase of that study has been completed. And I interviewed two of the people from that study. One of the interviews is in the book that you just read, and the other interview with Alexander Beiner is in the new book. Those were two of the courageous, brave people who went under for an hour. They were under the influence for an hour. There are other studies going on as well. There's another study going on in Colorado. There's one going on in Switzerland. And I think there's even a fourth study going on somewhere else. And they're currently underway as well. The study in Colorado, which I talk about at length in my new book, is especially interesting because they're specifically trying to communicate with the entities. And they've gotten some really fascinating results so far. Even they've even gotten results where they're communicating with the entities about how to improve the technology to communicate with them. So it's almost like, you know, like that, what was that Carl Sagan science fiction novel Contact, you know, where they supposedly sent instructions to us to be able to build a device that allows us to communicate with them. It seems like that's actually happening in real life, according to the researchers in Colorado, that the entities are helping them devise new technologies for better communication. And we can only speculate where this is going to go. I mean, will they help us, you know, with, can we be able to download, you know, instructions to build starships and time machines and, you know, matter transporters and, you know, God only knows what, you know, possibilities, you know, aliens that are more highly evolved than us may have hit upon a long time ago and could possibly share with us.
Yeah. I am deeply curious about this, deeply interested. I want to know more. And, you know, one of the things that comes into my mind, kind of the question is, you know, if we're able to develop this communication with them and people have been, you know, experiencing these short little trips for 5, 10 minutes, do they have anything where they come to us?
Where the entities what people have thought all throughout history that they've been able to. That's what, you know, my book doesn't only explore, you know, the DMT entity contact. It also goes into the alien abduction phenomena and fairy sightings and, you know, different types of encounters that people have reported all throughout human history, where it seems that, you know, alien intelligence have been, you know, messing with us or experimenting on with us or trying to communicate, you know, with us in some form. So many people feel that this is nothing new for them to try to reach out to us, but this DMT extended state phenomena is giving us the technology to reach out to them in return. So it can be a two-way street. And if there's a reality to this, one can only imagine that it's going to evolve into a hugely sophisticated science in the future, where we'll be able to communicate, you know, back and forth between worlds and realms and different forms of higher intelligence.
I would very much like to be around when that happens.
I hope so. Me too.
So I know that we're kind of running out of time, and I don't want to keep you beyond as much as I enjoy the conversation, but I do want to ask a question of you to you that you also have been asking in the book. And that's whether or not you think that we humans will still be around in about 100 years.
Yeah, well, it's certainly a crucial period right now in our evolution. There's no question about that. You know, I mentioned earlier that I think that psychedelics have become so popular and more accepted now because we're in an ecological crisis, and you know, the ecological crisis is pretty extreme. I mean, with the trajectory that we're on, is going to lead to our extinction pretty much, unless we change things or, you know, to turn it around in some way. You know, with that said, I am tremendously hopeful. All throughout human history, human beings are notorious for being able to find a way, you know, out of, you know, the crisis and the challenges that they face. And I think that, you know, with the greater awareness that we'll be gaining from psychedelics, and with the assistance of artificial intelligence that'll be raising our awareness even further, and the development of advanced technologies like advanced robotics and nanotechnology, which will allow us to increase the abundance of the resources that we have available to us. And I think that, you know, all these things kind of can culminate and come together to give us a real chance at being able to survive this bottleneck and get through this period of environmental crisis. But it's, you know, it truly is, you know, it's a genuine possibility that the human species could be headed towards extinction. I mean, we're now in the fifth, major extinction on our planet, and 99% of human, you know, of animals and plants that have lived on this planet have gone extinct. And there's no reason to think that, you know, that we're going to be any exception. So, you know, it's certainly a possibility, but I like to believe, and I find reason to, you know, for hope that, you know, that Gaia wants to keep us around, that she's got, you know, plans for our future evolution. You know, I have a teleology, you know, attached to my belief system and an intuition that things are moving in a positive direction, you know, also partially from my psychedelic experiences. I feel like I've been shown previews of, you know, where human beings either are headed or where they could be headed in our evolutionary future. So I remain hopeful and positive about where we're going. And I, you know, I just hope that we're going to make it and believe that everyone should be trying to do what they can to help raise consciousness on this planet before it's too late.
Yeah. Thank you. I agree 100%. And it's interesting, you know, people have been talking about a shift in consciousness for a long time and new paradigms and things like that. And I used to be pretty suspect of it. I used to criticize, I'm like, well, you just can't announce a new paradigm. But it does seem like we are in this tremendous moment of change. And I try to maintain hope as well. So I appreciate your hope. I appreciate the work that you do and all these conversations that you've had. I've appreciated the conversation that I've had with you. Let me ask you the final two questions. One is, what do you have coming up next? I know you've got a book coming out. Is there anything else that you're working on?
So in the next couple of months, that's the Illustrated Field Guide to the DMT Entities will be coming out. It's available for pre-order now. Stay current on other things that I'm doing. You can check out my website, www.davidjbrown, all one word, J-A-Y is spelled out, davidjbrown.com. And the new edition of my book, Mavericks of the Mind, is going to be coming out in a few months as well. That was the first interview book that I did back in the early 90s. There was a second edition, revised edition, published around 15 years ago. And this is going to be yet a third revised edition. We wrote new introductions, me and my co-interviewer together. And that's going to be published by Hilaritas Press sometime in the next few months as well. And other than that, I'm just going to take a break from writing for a while. I've been doing a lot of writing for the past couple of years, and I'll just be doing podcasts for a while. You're one of the first ones that I've done. When the new book comes out, I'd be happy to do another one.
I would love that. So, I have already put in my request for a review copy.
Great.
As soon as I saw it. And I'm curious, in the Mavericks of the Mind that's being re-released, is that, you said that was your first one. Does that have the Terrence McKenna interview?
Yes. That has the classic Terrence McKenna interview that we did. Right. The first interview in the book.
I'd be interested to read that, because I often wonder what he would make of what's going on right now.
Yeah, me too. I think about that a lot.
I miss him. Even though I never met him, I've known people who did. So he was a treasure. So, all right, I will put the link for your website and for Psychedelics in the Coming Singularity in the show notes in the video description. And my last question was your website, so we already answered that. So, David, thank you so much for your time. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. And again, I am very grateful for the work you've been doing.
Thank you. Bless you. I really appreciate your great questions. It was a lot of fun. Let's do it again.
Yes, we will. We will.
Okay.
And that's a wrap on episode 155 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. Now, most of my audience knows what's coming up next, all the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family and on social media too, please, and subscribe or follow the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the drill. But here's the thing. All of that is really important. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the front range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness, and psychedelics, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.